We're going to be returning to our study of the book of 1 Peter this morning. I have not actually preached in this building in probably 5 months or so. Didn't thumb back through the videos to find out, but I think it might have been 6 months because I think it was May. Last time that I spoke was in a home meeting, and that was 3 months ago when we were on the middle part of 1 Peter chapter 2. In this last section of chapter 2, in the opening section of chapter 3, Peter is giving us guidelines for dealing with some of the major relationships in our lives. The first one that he looks at is government, which is what we looked at last time. And then he looks at the relationship with employers and the relationship with one's spouse. We will not be reaching chapter 3 to talk about spouses today, but we will be talking about employer relationship in our role as servants in general. Last time, looking at government, we brought up a picture of Nero, which is not actually a picture of Nero, it's a rendering, but anyway, you remember his smug mug. And we talked about how God tells us to honor that person. We don't know if he looked like that, but we know what he was like. And he was just a lowlife in a crown. That's the type of king he was. And yet that's exactly who Peter was talking about when he said, honor the emperor. So we talked about how you can honor a guy like that just like you honor a crumpled $10 bill. No matter how dirty it is, no matter how twisted it is, it's still $10 because the government says it's $10. And God says a person is a person and worthy of being accepted at face value, no matter how bad that person's choices may be. We talked about how Jesus honored his own sinful creation and he submitted to them in every way that his role as a human walking in the world required, up to the point of paying voluntary taxes to support the temple, which was being mismanaged, by the way. So Jesus came down very low, and that's just one way that he came down very low for us in his relation to the governing authorities. So we now turn to from our calling as citizens to our calling as servants. And our main text today will be 1 Peter 2:18 to 25. Servants, be subject to your masters with all respect, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the unjust. For this is a gracious thing when mindful of God one endures sorrows while suffering unjustly. For what credit is it if when you sin and are beaten for it, you endure? But if when you do good and suffer for it, you endure, this is a gracious thing in the sight of God. For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example so that you might follow in his steps. He committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree, that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. By his wounds you have been healed, for you were straying like sheep, but now have returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls. This is a pretty long paragraph, and I didn't really find a good place to split it, so we're going to try to deal with the whole thing today. Starting with the question of who is a servant. Because the first word in this paragraph is servants, so this is addressed to servants, so we should try to figure out who he's talking about. The Greek word is, let's see, how do you say this? Oiketes. I'm probably saying it wrong, but what it means is a household slave. So this is kind of a more specific word than the general Greek word for servant. It means somebody who would work for another person without being paid and not having any choice in the matter, and who would live in the same house with that person. In the city of Rome, the population was around, I've heard anywhere from 25 to 75% slaves. So there was a huge, huge number of people in the Roman Empire who were enslaved. They did not really have much of a choice in their lives. That said, they were not necessarily as hard-worked or badly treated as we think of slavery in America. We think of the Old South and picking cotton. Slaves in Rome could be teachers, doctors. They had a number of different professional roles they could take on. So a slave in ancient Rome was roughly analogous to a worker in today's economy, with the exception that he did not have much choice, any choice, and they had very few rights. If you were killed by your master, there was a possibility he could be prosecuted. It wouldn't necessarily happen. So their lives, in other words, were very subject to the vagaries of whether they had a nice employer or a nasty employer. Quitting or going to the Department of Labor was not an option. Beyond people with the title servant, I want to take this a little further, because we could take this analogous to anyone who works in a company for someone else. I don't work for someone else. I get to be an owner in a company. But I also want to say that anyone who participates in an economy is functionally a servant. So you could say that if you work for someone else, you are in the servant role, and that's kind of true. But if you own that company, you are also in a servant role. Why? Because you serve your customers, from whom the money comes to pay your own employees. Or if you have investors, you serve your investors, on whom you depend for your job. If you think about it, anyone who participates in an economy is a servant, because the whole point of economics is that I give you something you want so that I can get what I want. And if you are participating in an economy and you are making a living without contributing anything at all and only by taking, you are probably either a trust fund kid or a politician or a crook. So if you work or participate in an economy in any way, then you are a servant in that sense, whether you own your own business or work for someone else or whatever you may do. But I want to go even further than that, because in Mark 10:44-45, Jesus says this to all his followers. He says, "Whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." Paul echoes this in 1 Corinthians 9:19, where he says, "Though I am free from everyone, I have made myself a servant to everyone, if by any means I might win anyone." So all believers are servants to one another through the church and to the world as the Lord calls us to win the world. So there is no one I am talking to who this following message does not apply to, because they're not a servant, because we all are servants, not in the sense of the people that he was writing to in that narrow sense, but in the broad sense we all are, usually in the economy and always in our personal lives. So this is addressed to us. So if we are servants, what does a servant do? A servant, well, servants do a lot of different things, but the role of a servant, if it is done properly, is to seek the good of the person who is being served. It doesn't necessarily mean give them everything they ask for. If you work for me and I ask you to go get me a gun so I can shoot myself, then, you know, technically you would be doing what I asked if you did it, but you would be serving me better to try to suggest another course of action that I might pursue other than shooting myself. So what you're doing when you do that is you are seeking my good. And a good servant will do this regardless of how the other person responds. So I want to look a little bit at the story of Joseph, which covers most of 12 chapters of Genesis from 39 to 50. And if you try to just sort of sit and read the story of Joseph, it's quite time consuming. So we're not going to be able to read through the entire story. He's a very large figure. I haven't looked at how many chapters are devoted to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but Genesis is 50 chapters, and Joseph is in about a quarter of them. So he is a pretty major figure. I'm going to start the story after Joseph has been betrayed by his brothers and sold out of his good position as the favored son of a tribal chieftain, namely Jacob. And he has been sold into a foreign country, does not have any prospect of ever returning. In Genesis 39:2, this is what it says about him. "The Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man. And he was in the house of his Egyptian master. His master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord caused all that he did to succeed in his hands. So Joseph found favor in his sight and attended him. And he made him overseer of his house and put him in charge of all that he had. From the time that he made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. The blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in house and field. So he left all that he had in Joseph's charge, and because of him, he had no concern about anything but the food that he ate." So Joseph has just been downgraded. He's been in this favored position where his father loves him more than all his other sons and gives him gifts and honors him, and he has dreams that he's had that God has sent him, promising that one day he'll be in this authority role. Everything's rosy. And suddenly he goes from up here on the Bronze Age social scale to way somewhere down here. Cast out of his family, he's cast out of his country, he's surrounded by people who don't worship the same God, and he is a slave. So from here, many people would go to self-pity. We would just kind of curl up, poor me, obviously my dreams were wrong, and God doesn't care. Instead, he rises to the occasion, and he becomes, if he is a slave, he becomes the best slave in the household, to the point where he is made manager. And I have people who work in our business, and I assign them work, and the person that I value the most is going to be the one whom I need to supervise the least. If I can just hand off and know that it's going to be done, then that's the person who's going to get the most assignments. That's the position we find here. He's become the ideal worker because he is looking out for his master's interests. He is serving him well to the point where he just sees the food that's on his plate and he doesn't think about anything else because he can trust that his employee is doing what he's supposed to be doing with integrity. Integrity is actually what brings him down out of this position, because in 39:6 and following, here's what we find out. Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. And after a time, his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Behold, because of me, my master has no concern about anything in the house, and he has put everything that he has in my charge. He is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" And as she spoke to Joseph day after day, he would not listen to her to lie beside her or to be with her. It would be hard to overstate the intensity of temptation that Joseph is undergoing here. He was 17 when he was sold into slavery. Probably took him a couple years to work up to this position in Pharaoh's house. So he's about 19 or 20 years old. He is single, and the boss's wife is asking to have an affair with him. Well, Joseph is a very healthy man in his prime, and there is so the temptation to give in to what she wants is extremely strong. And the temptation to his ego that the boss's wife is soliciting him would also be absolutely overwhelming. So this is a situation where most men, no matter how good character they appear to have, you put them in this particular situation, it would be extremely, extremely hard to say no, especially since he doubtless knew what the consequences would likely be when he did say no, that she would find a way to destroy him. As the playwright said, hell has no fury like a woman scorned, and that is exactly what happened in this case. While it might not be a true statement of women generally, it was very true of this one. And she did find a way to destroy him by slandering him to her husband. But I want to look at what his response was to her and what it shows. If there was one word that I could take to describe his response to her, because he doesn't just say, "No, forget it." He explains the reasoning behind his response. And if there's one word I could apply to that, it would be respect. So first of all, Joseph has respect to God. Now, respect, presumably, and I'd be lying if I said to look this up, but I am assuming that it comes from the same word as spectator, which comes from the Latin word for look. So when you respect, you look to. So he has not got his eyes locked on what he might want in terms of what she is offering him. He is looking to his God, first of all. He has respect for God. He says, "I can't do this because, not just because I would be sinning against Potiphar, but because I would be sinning against God." So this is at the core of his response to her. He is mindful of God. Remember what happened, what Peter says in the passage we read this morning. He says, "When you are mindful of God and you submit to your employer." And that, as we'll see, is the crucial phrase. He is also respectful toward his employer. Obviously, you commit adultery with somebody's wife, it is the ultimate insult to that person. He references her husband. He says, he has put me in a position of trust. I appreciate what he's done. He's given me all this responsibility, and I'm not going to betray his trust because of my respect for God. And you know something else? He's also respectful to Potiphar's wife. He is actually showing more respect for her than she is showing for herself. She is degrading herself to offer herself to him in the absence of her husband in adultery, and he is saying no to that. He is elevating her back up, saying, you are his wife. I'm not allowed to touch you. You are not available to me. You are not on that level. So Joseph models here respect for God and respect for people. That allows him to steer a straight course. And of course, he pays a very high price for it. She proceeds to get him thrown into prison. So I'm going to skim the narrative a bit here to where he is in prison. And we're going to start at verse 21. The Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison put Joseph in charge of all the prisoners who were there in the prison. Whatever was done there, he was the one who did it. The keeper of the prison paid no attention to anything that was in Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it succeed. We can get an idea of what kind of a person Joseph was in the prison. When these two new guys get thrown in the dungeon, and they look like they're having a bad day. And in 40 verse 6, Joseph came to them in the morning. He saw that they were troubled. So he asked Pharaoh's officers, who were with him in custody in his master's house, why are your faces downcast today? They said to him, we have had dreams and there is no one to interpret them. And Joseph said to them, do not interpretations belong to God? Please tell them to me. So if you talk to people who have been incarcerated, one thing they will usually tell you, if you're asking for what's important about, you know, living, getting by as an incarcerated person, is not to get involved with other people's problems. It's a good way to really mess your life up in prison. Joseph is ignoring this rule, and he is doing a lot more. We do see that as manager of the prison, he is clicked into exactly the same role he had with Potiphar. Almost the same words are used, referring to the warden, not even bothering to manage the prison anymore because Joseph is running everything so well. But he is doing more than just keeping order. He is actually taking care of people. He's going out of his comfort zone, say, you guys look like you're sad. Why don't you tell me what's wrong, and I'll see if I can help you. So you know how he went down from tribal chieftain's son to slave? Well, what's lower than slave? Incarcerated slave would be lower than slave. At that point, I don't know that there are any more rungs down the social ladder of ancient Egypt that are available to sink. That is about the lowest low you could get to in society, being a slave, incarcerated in the dungeon for an indefinitely long period of time. And yet, he does not sink into despair and start doing his job to the minimum. He does not become bitter. He doesn't even become emotionally inaccessible to other people. He is still the same guy. He is still looking to serve not only the person who has the power to punish him if he doesn't serve, but he's looking to serve his fellow prisoners for which he is under no obligation to do. And for which there is not much of a reward. We may remember that in verse 22, the cupbearer who he helped forgets him. And a couple more years go by. Now Joseph, of course, interprets the dreams of Pharaoh, and he goes in one day from the bottom of the Egyptian social order, the incarcerated slave, to the second highest position in the whole kingdom, being second in command to Pharaoh. And this is what he does in that position. Now we're going to skip over the part about Joseph and his brothers, which is the majority of the narrative, because we're looking today at what he is like as an employee. What is he like as a servant? This is one thing that he does specifically for Pharaoh, and it's found in 47:21 and following. He has used the assets which he advised Pharaoh to stockpile during the seven plentiful years. He has actually not only used them to feed the Egyptians, he uses them to strengthen Pharaoh's political position versus the Egyptians. As for the people, he made servants of them from one end of Egypt to the other. Only the land of the priests he did not buy, for the priests had a fixed allowance from Pharaoh and lived on the allowance that Pharaoh gave them. Therefore, they did not sell their land. Then Joseph said to the people, "Behold, I have this day bought you and your land for Pharaoh. Now he received for you, and you shall sow the land. And at the harvest you shall give a fifth to Pharaoh, and four-fifths shall be your own, and seed for the field, and as food for yourselves and your households, and as food for your little ones." And they said, "You have saved our lives. May it please my lord, we will be servants to Pharaoh." So Joseph made it a statute concerning the land of Egypt, and it stands to this day that Pharaoh should have the fifth. The land of the priests alone did not become Pharaoh's. What Joseph has done here, now, okay, we are democratically minded people. This probably doesn't sound like a very good plan to us, accruing power to the monarchy, where the monarchy actually owns the dirt and bosses everybody around. Historically, that has not been good in the long term for civilizations, for the most part. However, what it is to him here, what it is to Joseph, is the best thing he can do for his boss. He is looking out for Pharaoh's interests. And he does this without brutality, and actually the people are perfectly happy at the end of the day with the arrangement that he's made. Pharaoh could not have set up a better thing for himself. Why is he doing this? Because Pharaoh's writing the checks. Because he works for Pharaoh. And so he's going to do the very best he can to serve the person that he's working for. What we see here with him is a situation where, having gone from here to here and then back to here, he could have gone full Count of Monte Cristo. So I don't know if y'all are familiar with that story, but it's a novel about this French guy who gets unjustly imprisoned for years and years and years. And when he escapes, he finds this fantastic treasure. And then he goes around and systematically torments and murders everyone who was involved in throwing him in prison, which is kind of what you would expect from human nature, hence the story that people can relate to. But this is not what you see with Joseph. What is missing from Genesis 47? Well, maybe the part where Joseph decided to get revenge on Potiphar and his wife. Don't you think he could have? He's second in command to Pharaoh. He could probably do whatever he wanted to. But their names never come up again. He's not interested in that. And although he did not greet his brothers with open arms, at first what he was doing with them was for their good too. And this is how he summarizes it in 50:19, when Jacob has died and the brothers are worried that Joseph is going to get even with them now. But Joseph said to them, "Do not fear. For am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear, I will provide for you and your little ones." Thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. We see Joseph growing and maturing in character as he lives his life, as anyone will, but we also see that he is at his core essentially the same guy. He goes through maybe more swings of circumstance than anybody in the Bible, maybe except David. I'd have to think about it, but I would say Joseph is a top contender for the biggest swings of circumstances. He goes from tribal chieftain's son to slave manager, to incarcerated slave, to second in command of the kingdom. That is a lot of different situations you see him in. And in every situation, what is he doing? Neither unjust suffering nor unexpected prosperity change what he's doing. He's trusting God and serving people. That is what he is doing at every turn. And it's hard for me to read his story without feeling tremendous respect for him. And, as a person who is subject to a lot of mood swings, I would be the guy who would slump into despair or rage over what was going on. I greatly admire the grace that God had in Joseph's life, that he was able to act this way in the face of the circumstances that he had. There's a phrase that I think explains more than anything how Joseph was able to live his life the way he did, and how we are able to live life the way that God wants us to. It's a Latin phrase I had never heard, and it came up in a song. Like, what are they singing? What is that phrase they're singing? And listening to the song, I kind of understood it, but I looked it up later. The phrase is Coram Deo. So it is in, I believe it's sometimes presented with the solas of the Reformation, but it is a phrase from the Vulgate translation of Psalm 56:13. It means before the face of God. And it's a phrase that is intended to encompass the way that Christians live our lives Coram Deo, the before the face of God and all that that implies. At every turn, he is not weighing, in his greatest challenge, in his greatest challenge where the boss's wife is soliciting him. Let's zip back to that for a moment. He is not weighing the odds of getting caught. He is weighing the fact that God is watching. Not just, okay, God will punish me if I do the wrong thing here, but God is watching. That means a lot more than you might get punished for bad things that you do. He lived mindful of God, as Peter says in this passage. With an eye toward God, with respect toward God, he was able to be respectful and have a serving attitude toward people. We go to the next level, and we find that Peter is telling us that specifically, we should not only serve with respect nice people, the evil people. It says, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the unjust. So unjust, that's the Greek word scolios. If you're familiar with the medical condition of scoliosis, which means your back is crooked, that is where we get that word. So what he is literally saying is, have respect for crooks. Literally. Peter is writing to people who are about to undergo tremendous persecution. Every area of life, there was going to be a full court press against Christians. He's preparing them not only to survive, but to get through it with a right heart. And their area of employment is one area that's going to be a great challenge for them. How can you respect a crooked, corrupt person? Well, the same principle as before with Nero. We honor the image. If, first of all, you're a person, so you're an image bearer of God, so you have a value stamped on you, the same as every other person, and I will honor that like I honor the currency. But secondly, if you're my employer, then God has put you in that position. And no matter how bad an employer you might be, I should do my best for you and do it with respect to your position regardless. That's what he's telling us. And how do we do that? Well, it goes back to living before the face of God. I'm going to use an illustration of my children, which I pretty much do. If you want to fill out your bingo card, and you can check off Jason uses child illustration, because honestly, I don't know how people without children ever preach a sermon. But anyway, right now we're going through a phase where little Alicia, who's 10 months old, is too small to really know right from wrong, but big enough to do a lot of damage. And Matthew's main strategy when she starts coming over and clawing his face or taking his toy or something is to sit there and yell and protest rather than, you know, just, we're like, Matthew, just walk away. He can't really process that idea as yet. So what we'll say to him is, Alicia is too little to understand. Be gentle with her. Be patient with her. And he often does so and responds to her in a very mature way. Why does he do that? Well, it's not because he himself is naturally inclined to act that way, and it's not because Alicia appreciates it and says, why, thank you, Matthew, I appreciate your patience. Alicia is 10 months old. She is not capable of understanding whether he is responding to her with patience or not. He does it because he's doing it before the face of his parents. We pursue a parenting strategy where we do correct when there's bad behavior, but probably 10 times as often we try to commend good behavior. We speak to each other in our children's presence. Did you see this good thing that they did? Do you see how mature they're being? And this has tremendous effect on them. There's only one reason that he would choose to be patient with Alicia at 3 years old. That's because it pleases mommy and daddy. He knows we want him to do that, and we will be pleased with him if he does it. And what does Peter say? Be mindful of God, enduring suffering, and it is a gracious thing with him. You know what he means by that? I don't actually know why it's translated that way in the ESV, because almost every version says it's commendable, it's approvable, it's thankworthy. This is something that God counts in your column of rewards. Now, we don't earn his love, we don't earn our position in his kingdom through righteous deeds, so I'm going to put that asterisk there, but this receives his approval the same feeling that my three-year-old gets when I say, wow, he is doing an amazing job. That is the feeling we can anticipate and even have now when we know that God is smiling on our patiently enduring someone else's bad behavior, just as I smile on Matthew when he patiently endures Alicia's flailing. The respect that he shows for her is actually his respect for us. And the respect that we can show for governments, for employers, for people who are not acting the way that we should, that they should, is actually the respect that we have for God. I'm going to move to a much more serious example. It's an example of the best serving the worst, and it's from John 13. The best, we could only mean Jesus Christ. And by the worst, in the context of Christ, we could only mean his disciple Judas, who though with him for 3 years of ministry, even having his power and authority expressed through his own hands, chose to betray him. This is how Judas was treated by Jesus Christ in his last moments. John 13:2. During supper, when the devil had already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going back to God, rose from supper. He laid aside his outer garments, and taking a towel, tied it around his waist. Then he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel that was wrapped around him. The narrator makes it extremely clear that Judas was present when Jesus was modeling servanthood for the disciples with this graphic illustration of washing their feet, which was the type of, it wasn't a ceremony back then, it was a practical need, and it was usually taken care of by the lowest servants in the household. The narrator makes it a point that the devil had already put it into the heart of Judas to betray him, that Jesus knew this. In verse 10, he says, "You are clean, but not every one of you," for he knew who was to betray him. That is why he said, "Not all of you are clean." He could have waited until Judas was out of the room. He knew that he was leaving and what he was going to go do, but he didn't. He set us the example of washing the feet of someone who was not only not his master, Jesus was Judas's master, but who was going to betray him minutes later, who right then had decided to, and was harboring thoughts of doing that. When Jesus said that he did not come to be served, but to serve, he wasn't just talking about serving people who are nice to serve. He was talking about serving Judas Iscariot. And that's a standard higher than Joseph, higher than Paul, higher than me for sure, that Jesus Christ has set for us. You look at the way that he treats Judas. After he washes his feet, he includes him in the meal. He does not even accuse him in front of everybody. He says obliquely, "Do what you're going to do quickly." And his last recorded words, Matthew 26:50, to Judas Iscariot are, "Friend, do what you came to do." He treats him gently and respectfully to the very end, even though the man he's talking to is the closest to Satan in human form that you could have. That is the Savior who walked ahead that we could follow in his steps. What did he not do? Peter warns us by pointing out what Jesus did not do. He did not revile. What is reviling? Reviling is exacting retribution from somebody through insult. So I may not be able to stop what you did. You may have already done it, but I'm going to insult you and make you feel bad. And that will make me feel like I evened the score. Could Jesus have done this? Jesus looked at Peter, and Peter ran away and wept bitterly. Jesus could have destroyed Judas psychologically with one word, or destroyed any of the people who were abusing him the same way. And he didn't do it. He could have made sure that none of them could sleep at night for the rest of their life without ever laying a hand on them or sinning. That he would not even use his words to even the score with others. Peter says Jesus did not threaten. Do you know that the admonition not to threaten is given both to masters and to servants? We are very, very inclined to use threats as a manner of getting our way. Reviling is a way of getting even. Threatening is more a way of changing the other person's behavior. If you don't do this, I will do that. Or if you do this, I won't do that. Could Jesus have done this? Well, Jesus is actually going to come back and judge the world. So if anybody had something to threaten you with, it would be Jesus Christ. But he chose not to. And by doing so, he set us the example so that we could follow in his steps even when we suffer. Do you want to be like Jesus? If you don't want to be like Jesus, if you just want to get out of hell, I don't think that you're a believer. We all want to be like Jesus. Just like our children want to be like us. It's often really cute when our children do something that they saw us do. Matthew is now getting to where he can do a little more complex pretending. He often asks me, where are you going? I say, I'm going to work. He says, oh, don't go to work. I say, what will happen if I don't go to work? He says, we won't have any money. That's right. If I don't go to work, we won't have money. So I'm at work, and he's sitting over there doing something, and he says to his mother, I'm working to get money for us. And he brings her his wallet, which doesn't actually have anything in it, and he hands her some imaginary money and says, here's some money. Because this is what he observes that I'm doing. This is what Julia talks about. Daddy's going out to make money for us. We need this. So, that must be important. That must be what men are supposed to do. That's what I should be doing. So he pretends to be doing it. Nobody has to tell him. Now, Matthew, remember, you should want to be like Daddy. And I don't think anyone's going to have to tell Alicia, remember, you should want to be like Mommy. You need to get some dolls and pretend to take care of them and go in the kitchen and pretend to cook. She will most likely do all of those things just because that's what she sees her mother doing. She wants to be like her. And that is the natural course of things in the family of God also. We should want to be like Jesus. We should want it not as an upgrade, but more than anything. He didn't just die for us to get us a ticket out of hell. When John talks about when we see him face to face, he doesn't say, and we'll be safe from the fires of hell forever. He says, we will be like him because we see him face to face. Like this, people, is the prize. We have a little preview of it here. He starts to come through us. We're still very human. Jesus Christ would not do the majority of things that I do, and that is on me. When we see him face to face, we'll be perfectly like him. And we should long for that. We should long for it to be more now and complete later. And this is what Peter invokes. He says, you have been called to this because Christ suffered for you. And Jesus is talking about being kind to unthankful people, which is very closely related to what we're looking at. He doesn't say, do this so I will give you rewards. We will have rewards. And he says, do this so that you can be like your Father, because that's what he does. And I hear him saying, don't you want to be like me, son? Don't you want to be like me, daughter? Don't you care if your life looks like mine or not? Do we care? It's really what it comes down to. Are we ever called to forget about justice, to forego compensation, to be martyrs, as it were? Actually not. There will be justice. There will be compensation. Jesus himself did not accept injustice, full stop. He entrusted himself to the righteous judge. He knew more than anyone the consequences that would one day come on the people who crucified him. He prayed, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. We will get our reward. We are not called to not want good things. We are not called to enjoy being humiliated or abused or to always be the slave in the dungeon. We are called to accept what God puts in our path now, knowing that our time is coming later. How can we live like that? Well, the good news is, as Peter tells us, by his wounds you have been healed. We died to sin and lived to righteousness. We were straying like sheep, but now have returned to the shepherd. A shepherd is not someone who says, look over there, sheep, go get what I have for you. He's the one who goes in and out with you and who gives you the ability to acclaim what he has set before you. And that is what Jesus did for us. When Peter says you were healed by his wounds, I do not believe that he meant we would never suffer from illness. I realize there are some people who do believe that. I think there is a preponderance of both scriptural and actual evidence which shows pretty clearly that is not what is meant here. Is physical healing available within God's will? Absolutely it is. And I think all of us have had it. But there is a type of healing everyone needs that is guaranteed. And that is the healing from the broken nature that absolutely always, no questions, has to sin. Do we sin? Yes. Do we have to sin? No. If the chains are on, they're not locked. He gave us a new nature with which to do what seems to be impossible and walk the way he walked in the face of suffering and injustice. And I believe that is the healing in his wounds that is for every believer. So what have we looked on? Every Christian, free or slave, or employed or unemployed, you are called to live with the mindset of a servant. Because our Lord lived with the mindset of a servant. If Jesus Christ can wash the feet of Judas Iscariot, who had already decided to betray him, I can't think of a situation where serving is too humiliating, too difficult, too much of a step down, too unmotivating, too depressing, too whatever. Because whatever I might be experiencing, it was 1,000 times more in that upper room. And Jesus did it. If we serve, I would say that's going to bring us some suffering. Not necessarily because the people we're serving are going to beat us, which is actually possible. But in most cases, the suffering that we're going to undergo in serving others is more the suffering, as in the term long-suffering, we will put up with. It is hard to serve another person because I'm subjecting my needs to your needs. That makes things inconvenient for me. It doesn't allow me to have my preferences about things. And so, whether there is pain involved or not, I'm going to suffer with that. God calls us to give respect to everyone, including the worst people, because of his image. And God calls us to live this way because we want to resemble Christ, who is dying to be the master of everything, who wants more than any other creature in the universe to be in charge. Satan. Sergio said something that he had heard a few weeks ago. He mentioned that when you sin, Satan is like, that's my boy. That is really stuck in my head. When we are lording it over other people, wanting to be the master and not wanting to be the servant, we're wearing our Satan hat, as it were. I don't want to be like him. This is a lesson of starting. It's funny how when you simplify lessons for your children, it really helps you internalize them. I tell him, if Matthew's being selfish, I say, no, Matthew, you're being selfish. You should be generous. He says, why? Why is his favorite word right now? As I heard myself saying, because God is generous. Do you want to be like God or Satan? So I don't want to be like God. God is generous. Satan is selfish. You know, that's true. I thought about that. And if you take that, you take it to pride and humility, you take it to this grasping to be in charge versus willingness to be the servant. When we walk the other way from Christ, we're walking, trying to be like Satan. Well, he's not our father. He's the father of the lost, not the found. So let's strive to be like our Savior and not our enemy. Do we believe that God's favor shines on us when we obey his commandments? Do we really think that? Do we think about it? You know, Matthew gets to hear my voice saying, you did a good job, son. I don't get to hear God's voice, for the most part. And that's one reason it's important for us to encourage each other, because God does not generally boom from heaven. He has called us to build one another up. One way we do that is to say, you know, I saw this in your life. I know this pleases our Father. He has not revealed his voice to us yet to tell us directly, well done. But he does send us to do so with each other and encourage each other. If we are aware of God, if we are living coram Deo, before the face of God, it changes everything. I was talking about how I came into church this morning very frustrated because I'm trying to get my sermon ready. My daughter's sick. My internet's not working. My printer's not working. My computer's not working. The Zoom call's not working. It's just all really, really annoying. And then we started worshiping the Lord. I focused back on Him. You know, those are small things. Jesus Christ dying to give me life is a big thing. It's the big thing. And as I focus on that, we talked, wasn't the message, we were talking about the Catechism in Pilgrim's Progress, where Christian is asked, how do you overcome your annoyances? And he says, when I think about the cross, so I overcome my annoyances. I should probably put that up on my wall. It's not forever. We live a life where there will be some injustice. You know, there was a, I love the Babylon Bee. And after the election, it came out the way it did, which a lot of people didn't like. There was a story that said after election, Republicans briefly considered putting their trust in God again. And it was kind of true. You know, I'm not taking political sides when I say that. I'm just saying that, we'll just say Republicans were not happy with the outcome because they lost. That is true. It's also true that whatever your political persuasion, our hope is in our God, not in somebody in the White House or somebody in Jefferson City or somebody in the Polk County Courthouse, for that matter. Our hope is in our God. And He will fix everything at the end of the day. Colossians 3:23 through 24 says this. Whatever you do, work heartily, as for the Lord and not for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the inheritance as your reward, for you are serving the Lord Christ.